He's defeated every champion from every organization the sport of mixed martial arts has ever seen, and retired from the octagon as the biggest draw and the industry's highest paid athlete of all time. And now Chael Sonnen's on podcast1.com. And for that, you're welcome.
Happy Wednesday, everybody. I am Chael Sonnen. Awesome show coming up today. Mick Foley will be the guest. Mankind, Cactus Jack, the author of Have a Nice Day, and an all-around really interesting guy who I really can't wait to talk to. I've got a list of topics here that I want to cover purely as a fan. As a fan myself, I sent out a tweet earlier today. I said I'm going to have him on. Send in your questions. I got some great questions from the listeners here. And I'm worried I'm not going to have enough time with him. I really am. I've got so many things I want to go over. It's an exciting day. You know, last week's podcast, we did the smack off. Did the smack off with Jim Rome. And this thing went crazy. You know, I had a lot of fun with it. It was fun for me, but I was a little surprised at how much you guys enjoyed it. I get a lot of nice compliments said. And that's always fun to hear, but I've never done a show that had as much passion behind the compliments as last week's Smack Off with Jim Rome. And it was largely due, not only to my partner Mike and Indy, but it was largely due to my producer Jacob, who came in and got everything right. The house was on fire around here. It was live. There was no retakes because we're live merging and mixing the Jim Rome show with this podcast, marrying them into one and putting that out to you guys, the listener. And we just couldn't have done it without Jacob. He really was the star of the show. So I want to give a quick shout out to him. Now, you know, guys, the big news in MMA since we've talked last is that Jose Aldo is out. Now, I've done several interviews about this where I've been asked my opinion of this and Aldo out and Mendez in. And whenever I do the interview, somebody recaps the interview, miscategorizes the headline, and it bothers me. That's the world that I live in. That happens a lot. It doesn't really matter what the body of your statement is. What really matters is what the headline says it is. And when the headline gets it wrong, you can kind of be left a little bit frustrated. And here's the thing, guys. We never kick somebody when they're down, ever. And Jose Aldo is down. The guy is hurt and is going to miss the biggest fight of his career that will never be back. You can have all of the unattached, uninformed outsiders say, well, he'll just do the rematch when he gets healthy. Yeah, he may do the match, but the opportunity's gone. The match will never be as big as it would have been had he participated this Saturday. The hype machine, the money and the marketing spent on it will not be duplicated. You can't. You can't risk it on a guy that's pulled out of five fights and burned you once. You don't go on another world tour. That's just a reality. So Jose Aldo is down. I would not kick him when he was down, ever. Ever. To bring up the fact that I am confused as to how these reports even got out. He's in training camp. His teammate kicks him recklessly. This is 100% the teammate's fault. If I'm sparring with a guy and my partner shows up and doesn't have headgear, I'm the right guy to go with. I will not hurt him. I know what I'm doing. If I have a partner that shows up and he doesn't bring a mouthpiece, I'm the guy to go with. Spar with me. I will not hurt you. Your teeth will not leave any looser than they are when you walk in. If my partner gets hurt, it is my fault. So this is 100% Jose's partner's fault. Why he thought he should throw a kick that hard is beyond me. Accidents happen, guys. What accidents are called is cuts. You guys headbutt each other on accident. Guy cuts his eye. Guy runs into an elbow. Guy runs into something and he gets a cut. Those are accidents. You're talking about an injury that ends a world title fight. You're talking about carelessness. This is a careless mistake. And I'm not saying we should throw the workout partner away. I'm just saying it's a teachable moment and we need to recognize that this is his fault. The problem here is that the partner that threw the kick then went on a media tour 24 hours later telling the story. What kind of a teammate puts the champ down and then does a media tour and puts his own name out there and tells people what happened. At what point have practice room secrets and secrets of the workout room stopped being secrets? I don't understand. So you got Jose Aldo, who's been talking for years that he wants to go up a weight class, wants to leave his weight class. Now his coach comes out, says he doesn't want to coach him anymore, that this might be his last fight. And you got a teammate so careless that he breaks his rib and then goes on a media tour telling people how he's the one that did it. Man, that's a head scratcher to me. But none of those are put downs to Aldo. And a lot of the media made it as though I had put Aldo down. And it bothered me. It really bothered me because you got a guy that's down and out and you don't take shots at him. You just simply don't do it. The x-rays that have come out for you conspiracy theorists have also raised some concerns. I'm looking at the x-ray. I'm not trained in radiology. I don't have any idea what I'm looking at, but I'm looking at what appears to be a rib cage, and one of the lower ribs is broken in two. That's what it looks like to me from my iPhone when I blow it up and I just stare at it, my little handheld. That's what it looks like to me. But we've had doctors that come out and said, no, you're actually not seeing what you think you're looking at. So that isn't a rib that you see broken there. It's a crystallized calcification of the cartilage. That's not bone at all. Now, again, my eyes are telling me something different, but I don't really know what I'm looking at. I'm not trained in this. But for what I was looking at, I thought it was pretty clear. I thought it was a broken rib. But doctors are coming out and saying, no, it's not. Now we're getting reports saying the x-rays that were released by Aldo are not even his x-rays, that they're not the x-rays that were submitted from doctor to doctor by facsimile. I tend to not believe that one. I do not believe that Jose Aldo went out and manufactured a set of x-rays. I don't know how we do it. What do you do? You go on Google and you screenshot something and then you put it out. I think it's ridiculous and it's conspiracy theorist. But the doctors in Nevada are maintaining that it is not a broken rib and that he was cleared to fight. I think that's interesting. I also think the part of the story that went untold because Jose didn't tell it wasn't a matter that he wasn't tough enough to walk out there and do it. I think if you're immobilized with a rib, I've never had a broken rib, guys, but boy, I had torn cartilage, which is a far cry from a broken rib. A broken rib is exponentially worse than what I have experience in, and what I have experience in was terrible. Oh my gosh, it hurt so bad. When you tear the cartilage around your rib, that's how you've heard of a popped out rib. You go, well, what does that mean? You popped a rib? Well, when the cartilage tears and the rib comes out of place, it pops out. It was immobilizing. It hurt so bad. You almost couldn't do anything, including sleep, because now you can't breathe. You can't cough. You can't sneeze. You can't do anything. It really, really stops you. So if Jose had that, the bigger problem is if you can't move and you can't run and you can't exercise and do the things needed, it's not a matter of being tough enough on fight night. You can't beat the scale the night before. If you can't move, you can't cut weight. If you can't cut weight, there's no fight. I think that's probably, I'm guessing here, Jose never said this, I'm just being a fellow athlete, put myself in his shoes type situation. I think that's probably what really held him up, is he couldn't make the weight. He didn't do himself any favors in the media. It doesn't do him any good when a teammate, a reckless and careless teammate, threw a kick hard enough to break a guy's ribs, goes out and does a media tour for himself. That's confusing to me. And enough of that. Let's get on with the show. Let's get to Mick Foley. And before we do that, have I told you guys all about the fantastic offer going on over at DraftKings.com? If you guys think you're an MMA fanatic and you're proud of it, you know all the fighters, you know all the matches, you're listening to the number one MMA podcast right now. It's time to put your knowledge to the sport to the test. At DraftKings.com, an exclusive daily fantasy sports partner of the UFC, you can win huge prizes every time you play. Let me tell you what you do. Go pick five fighters, pummel the competition, and pick up your cash. That's it. Score points for significant strikes, takedowns, advances, knockdowns, and more. You could win a piece of $1 billion in prizes being awarded this year alone. These are the biggest daily fantasy MMA contests anywhere, and they're only at DraftKings.com. Hurry over to DraftKings.com. Use the promo code CHAEL, C-H-A-E-L, and play this weekend. You could win UFC 189 VIP tickets. That's going to include travel and accommodations, VIP passes to UFC International Fight Week events, and VIP tickets to UFC 189. Enter CHAEL right now at DraftKings.com. That's DraftKings.com. I said DraftKings.com. When we come back, Mick Foley.
Yo, it's your boy KFC, and this is Mail Time. We call it the laziest hour of your day to help you get through your 9-to-5 job, but in reality, it's just unfiltered access to the mind of two idiots and the stupid things coming out of their mouths. Whether you're sitting at your desk, commuting in the morning, at the gym, whenever you listen to two idiots rambling, you'll always feel better about yourself. It's Mail Time. New episodes are available every Wednesday for download on the Podcast One Network.
This is Your Welcome with CHAEL Sonnen.
All right, we're back to Your Welcome, and as promised, joined by Mick Foley. Mick, what's going on, man?
CHAEL, how are you doing? Thank you very much for having me on the show today.
I'm pumped. I'm so excited to hear. Mick, where are you calling in from? Where in the country are you?
I am in the Foley year-round Christmas room in Long Island, New York.
Now, you love Christmas, by the way. I when I go online and I do a search for Mick Foley, I see more pictures of you dressed as Santa Claus pop up as I do you on top of Hell in the Cell. What is your attachment to Santa Claus?
Oh, man. I've never had a psychological profile done about it, but I imagine it goes back to my days on the road, full-time with WWE when I had... And even going back to WCW when I had little kids and I was away a lot, and I think I just found a lot of comfort because I was in a lot of physical discomfort most of the time, and being away from your family kind of stings, and I just found a lot of comfort in celebrating Christmas, looking forward to it, and then in 2000 creating my own, when it was time to create my own man cave instead of surrounding myself with like cool stuff from my career. I just got as far away from my career as I could and just like put Christmas stuff up all around.
So what does that look like? I'm picturing this cave. So you're saying there's not a bunch of Mick Foley pictures and the old hardcore belt and whatnot, but that rather you got jingle bells and red and white hats up all around? What does the man cave look like?
Well, you know what? What I'll do is an exclusive. When you give me the link, I'll put a couple photos up so people can see it. It's funny because I don't know why, but I don't have a single wrestling photo in my house. Not even in my my photo albums. The only photo I have of me with any wrestlers is when I took a picture with Becky Lynch and Sasha Banks backstage at a NXT show, and I told them that they were the first entry. I don't know why that is, but I do have photos of me like with my kids as Santa, and I know it's probably a little scary. If people do Google my name and Santa Claus, they'll see that not only are there a lot of photos, but that I'm not a toe dipper, CHAEL. I dive right in,
Oh, I've seen the pictures. I think you make a hell of a Santa Claus.
And actually, there's only one thing on my me wall. I'm looking at it now. It's a photo of me when I appreciated this moment because for a while I felt like I'd lost my edge. Like society had kind of beaten me down. And then one day I was a guest for a friend of mine who plays bass with Norah Jones. And at the end of the show, it was their Christmas special, Norah was singing Silent Night, and I just thought to myself, if I don't walk up to that microphone and start singing with her as Santa, I will never forgive myself. And for about 7 months, I thought if you'd ask Norah Jones about me that she would say, oh, the wrestling guy ruined Silent Night. But what I didn't know was that it had kind of like made this lasting impression on her. And I have this quote from an interview she did. It's right underneath. I'm looking at the photo now. Beautiful photo of me and Norah singing. And it just says, and it's the quote from her. She said, it was so surreal. He looked so real. Mick is Santa, and it's got the little thing on parchment paper, Nora Jones. So that's like my only celebrity photo in the entire Foley house.
That's beautiful. Now, when you don't put that stuff up, is that have any relation because you have kids? And the reason I ask that is I just had my first a month ago. I don't have like a shrine to myself in my house either, but what very few photos I did have, I took down as soon as my son was born. The only photos that will go up in my house will be of him. I don't want him growing up staring at my stuff. That's a little bit weird. But is any of that, do you relate to any of that?
Yeah, definitely. And I was just, you know, trying to do my feeble research, and I came across an article, I think just yesterday, where you said you didn't want to be that guy driving around in the Trans Am with his old Letterman jacket on. And I think there's a healthy balance. You know, you want to respect what you did. You want to appreciate it. But, I assume you're like me, like where very few days go by where someone doesn't stop you and let you know that they appreciated what you did. Like, I get all the appreciation I need from going out and, you know, and seeing people. Like, I just, it's a funny thing. I think I'm the same way, because I did have a me wall, and I was wondering, especially with the passing of Dusty Rhodes in the early 90s, Dusty was my booker, and really the guy who gave me, you know, was responsible for giving me my biggest break in 1991, and I got a chance to wrestle main event matches with Sting, and he really put me on the national map. And there was this picture of Dusty interviewing me, and I wanted to find that photo, because suddenly, you know, with his passing, it meant so much to me. But with that being said, when I had the me wall, because in the early 90s, some of my matches, you know, were wild and kind of graphic, I remember like a friend from college coming over to visit, and she was just stunned by the percentage of photos, you know, involving, you know, blood. Like, it never even crossed my mind that would be a strange thing for someone to walk into a basement and see photos of somebody.
That's your history, though. That's your history.
Yeah. But I don't think that's strange at all. I think it's a good thing with you being a dad. It kind of put those things away and concentrate on the family photos.
Yeah, and if your friend didn't want to see blood, I mean, her other choices were missing teeth and pulled out hair. I mean, would have that made her... would have that made her feel better?
I don't. You know what? This is. It's not exactly breaking, but I haven't talked about it. I've mentioned it on social media,
but I haven't actually talked
about the case of the missing teeth, because the Hell in a Cell match was 17 years and 1 week ago, and I put this post up, and it just went crazy. Like the number of people, you know, way above and beyond, like, you know, tenfold or more of what usually respond to my thing. So it obviously is a memory that people really appreciate and kind of hold dear. And it's just within the last month that I realized, and we actually came from being Santa, and I did a commercial with my daughter as my elf for WWE, where I looked at that thing and I was like, Santa doesn't have a blue tooth, because my teeth had been damaged in that match. And that was really my decision to finally, you know, fix those teeth up. The four that had been, not the two that were missing on the top, they'd been missing since late 89. And I don't mind those at all. But in the terms of my youngest son, who's a straight shooter, 12 years old, straight shooter, and he goes, Dad, he goes, don't take this personally, but you used to look kind of cool. Now you just look like a meth addict.
How would you take that personal?
He went to see my one man show, and he goes, Dad, don't take this personally. You're entertaining, but you're not funny.
That's all. You know, my buddy Douglas Crosby, I was talking to him earlier today. He lives out in Long Island. Yeah, he brought up the one man show. He said that the one man show is awesome. He said he's never actually got to see it. He just got excerpts. And he's trying to. How often are you doing those?
Man, I love doing them. I just did a special for WWE Network called Cheap Pops, and it was kind of it was a show I'd been, you know, stories I'd actually been working on. When I started doing these things, I thought every city deserves a new show, which is another way of saying every city gets a poorer show than they should have.
Sure.
A less refined show. And I think the difference between doing like wrestling promos and telling stories is the stories get better with time. You find different things and lines that are funny and different nuances. Whereas the promo I always thought was best given, you know, like raw and from the heart, and the less refined, the better it was. But now that I've done that show, I'm really like kind of scrambling. I had an idea. This is more breaking news on your show. Like, I had all these ideas written down, and then I realized what I was coming with was kind of like a depressing show about my journey through head injuries. And I thought, I don't want this to be my my Garth Brooks. Remember Garth Brooks did the kind of the concept album that nobody bought. Like I think when I go out there and I and I'm on a stage and people are paying their money, you know, that my job is to entertain them, not to get heavy subjects off my chest. So I'm kind of restructuring it, kind of taking it easy for most of 2015. Then I'll come back strong with a real world tour in 2016.
I love it. I want to catch the show. You know, I like wrestling, but I love wrestling psychology, and I love the way that they can evoke an emotion and evoke the exact emotion that they're after. It's very, you know, it's very high level and very intelligent the way that wrestlers go about that. But here's my question. Like guys in MMA that get it, that understand the psychology, they're very few and far between. And the ones that get it had to get there on their own. There was no class. There's no sit down with the bosses. There's no writers. There's nothing like that. It's you either get it or you don't, and most guys don't, but the few that do really stand out. In wrestling, here's my question. In wrestling, is there a class? Is there a book that you guys all trade amongst yourselves? Or is it just, you know, guys in the van and back behind the curtain, and you share ideas, and eventually you either get it or you don't?
Well, you know, it's a combination, because for many years there was a term, I think it's still used, called, you know, booking the territory as you drive, because there'd be four or five guys in a car, and especially guys, you know, who weren't making a lot of money at the time, they'd be like booking the territory and coming up with ideas and batting things around. And like, I'm just recalling like Stone Cold Steve Austin when he was stunning Steve Austin, and William Regal when he was Steven Regal in WCW, and the idea that you'd be driving around and tripling up in a $30 Econolodge and just batting around ideas. I mean, that's all you did. These days, you know, I think Mr. McMahon was correct in seeing that sometimes promos or interviews were getting away from people. And I think The Rock and I are primarily to blame for the advent of the scripted promo, because the This Is Your Life segment that set some kind of ratings record was supposed to go 14 minutes and went 26. And I was told that Mr. McMahon had to be physically restrained from coming out and stopping the the proceedings.
From just saying, you know, enough, move on.
Yeah. And I have no proof that it was at that moment where he said, we're going to start structuring these. But I think when you structure the promos, you know, if you want to say script them, that what you do is, like, you eliminate the chances for disasters, but you also kind of, like, take away the chances, the opportunities for something magical to take. You know, in wrestling, it might be, you know, Stone Cold's, you know, Austin 316 promo, which you never could have scripted for the guy. But they do now offer classes. And I mean, with the passing of Dusty Rhodes, there's a big hole there in the WWE developmental system. He's Dusty was like a father figure to so many of the guys, and people were coming up and getting the reps in. It's weird, because when I say getting the reps in, I look back like when WWE did a really nice DVD on me about a year and a half ago, and during the course of the DVD, you could see me kind of progressing as a guy on the microphone. And it's good that I got a chance to get those reps in and make mistakes on the smaller stages, so that when I finally got, you know, my biggest chance, I was, you know, kind of primed and ready. The current guys, they don't have that luxury. You know, like, when they get the chance, their mistakes are out there on national television, and so they need guys like a Dusty Rhodes or other guys, now that Dusty's gone, to come in and help them with that. There is no textbook, but And I still feel like the best way to connect is from, you know, is from the heart. Even if you know that your goal is to create, and you're saying is to create chaos, and you understand that you're in a group with really talented people, and I imagine at some point in your own career you said to yourself, how do I stand out? And,
sure.
The answer is, you have to make people care about you. And I think that's where, the connection between pro wrestling and MMA is that there's lots of great athletes out there, a lot of great fighters. How do you make somebody care about you? And it's not easy.
Who was your inspiration? When you were a kid and dreaming about being a wrestler, who did you look at?
You know what? There is this one moment in time where I hitchhiked from my college in Cortland, New York, to New York City.
That's safe. Good.
Yeah. So, in the interest of full disclosure, I did take the bus to 40 miles to Binghamton, and then I hitchhiked.
A bus in New York, also very safe. Good. We're off to a great start.
And at the age of 18, I did try to buy a handgun on the streets. This is more breaking news.
Sure.
So, I'd been greatly influenced by Robert De Niro and Taxi Driver, and thought you could just find a guy like that who could get you firearms.
Well, and how did it go? I would imagine you probably could.
I did meet a guy who offered to bring me to a location, and then even at 18, I was like, I don't think this is going to end well. Let me just take my memories of Jimmy Snuka diving off the top of the cage and try to catch a bus back to college. But that was seeing Snuka up on top of that cage and seeing how he captured people, not just with the dive, but with the build-up. It was like the story, the anticipation, looking up at the crowd, looking up at the cage, at the top of the cage, because he was known as a guy who came off the top rope. And a year prior to this big match in 83 with Don Morocco, he'd come off the top of the cage in a match with Bob Backlund. Backlund rolled out of the way. But even in defeat, Snuka was clearly like the victor. He was like just glorious in defeat. And so there was a definite buzz that night at the Garden that he was going to go to the top again. And so when he looked up at that cage, and he just had a way, balance was impeccable, and his way of controlling the crowd, looking out. And I described it in the book that I wrote. I still remember, his body bathed in both blood and flash bulbs. And it was still like the most amazing sight I'd ever seen. Even given that people have done more athletic, crazier things, it was just that moment in time where everything was perfect. And for me, always being more of like a performer than a competitor, it was just that idea that you could create that kind of magic, and that you could create images. I didn't know in 83 that, geez, I'll still be talking about this thing 32 years later. But I think when pro wrestling is at its best, or when MMA is at its best, or any sport, you end up with this handful of memories, that you never forget. And going back to what I said about trying to, separate yourself from the pack, it's the people who are capable of creating those memories, whether they're wrestling matches or fights, I think, that go on, to live on, in people's hearts and minds forever.
Yeah, I'm out here in Portland, Oregon right now, and Jimmy Snuka came through this territory back when it was Don Owens promotion. We had a small promotion. Yeah, it was incredible. The absolute legends came through there. So, Snuka's near and dear out here, but I will tell you, when you climb up to the top of that cage, at some point he must have had second thoughts. I mean, there he is in front of the world, standing on that cage. I went through the WCW power plant back in the day, and I just went through the tryout process where then you had to get invited back, and the next step was to come and do the training. And one of the biggest things that I took away, Mick, from my whole experience there was I watched the guys tear down and set up the ring one day. And that ring that everybody talks about wrestling being staged and it's choreographed, that ring was made of nothing but iron, plywood, and then a quarter inch of carpet pad. And I came home, and that was the thing I told my dad. You know, we were always taught that underneath that apron, it was basically like a trampoline and springs.
Yeah.
And I said, Dad, none of that's true. I watched it with my own eyes. This thing is nothing but iron and plywood with a little bit of carpet pad. So that's the one thing that a lot of people don't always appreciate. They see a guy like Jimmy Snuka jump off a cage. They say, you come through a cage or come off of the top of one into an announcer table. And they think it's this high-level, high-budget Hollywood scripted thing. It's like, no, it's not. That's a real table, and he just jumped through it, and there's no strings attached. But people miss that. If it's on TV.
After that match in 98, they did bring in a guy, you know, who would coordinate some, for lack of a better word, some stunts. And I think fans saw through that because they'd be like, oh, that was a crash pad there. We're not seeing people landing. Even with my son, the 12-year-old, when he was 8 or 9, he'd be like, Dad, why aren't they showing them landing? I don't think they're landing. I think there's got to be something there. Otherwise, they'd be showing people landing. And I think that's a move for the, you know, that's a wise move to keep the guys from, because, you know, guys will do whatever it takes to get to that next level. And it's nice, even that night after that cell match where Mr. McMahon came in, and he said, you have no idea how much I appreciate what you've just done for this company. But I never want to see anything like that again.
And then was that his response?
Yeah, it really was. Yeah. So whenever people, like, even when I've had my, my trouble with the company, you know, like, I will never forget that his first response, you know, to what I had done was to tell me never to do anything like that again. And when I told him I was having problems with my, you know, memory from head injuries in 1999, he told me I just had my last match. Like, he didn't stop and say, Wick, you're a big asset to this company. You know, he was genuinely concerned about my well-being. I don't think most people hear that side of Vince McMahon.
That surprises me. But, you know, I put myself in Vince's shoes that night and thought, well, what do you say to the guy? I mean, you just come in and shake his head. We're almost dumbfounded even as fans at what we had just seen. And that was before everything was revealed to us slowly over the years that wasn't all part of the plan, you know, that wasn't all as you and Taker had agreed for the spot. And I've always thought, you know, I wonder what Vince's reaction was. Was it sure whore? Was it sure, oh, man, ratings are going to go crazy? So that's
was,
I appreciate
yeah,
hearing
he was
that.
Genuinely concerned for me, and one of the things I bring up in the one man show, it's kind of last year's story, is that we're in this one. The irony is, you know, we were in the fake sport or the show business sport. But it was actually at the time the only sport that would continue when one of the participants was no longer conscious. And I sometimes think about the policy today, obviously, to be, boom, somebody's unconscious. And I just saw it happen at an NXT show where they were like, I think the guy's out. And they just stopped the match right there. That's like the best move and obviously the responsible move. But if they'd stopped that match in 1998 when I was knocked out, it wouldn't have connected with people the way it has. It was kind of like looking at the wreckage and trying to figure out how these guys, like, we know these guys have a planned outcome. How do they get to that outcome when one of the guys is no longer, you know, no longer there? And it was really dramatic. I remember my wife saying to me about 3 years ago, she goes, the kids have heard about this match. They've seen the clips. They want to watch that match. And I sat and I watched it in its entirety for the first time in many years. I'd seen the clips hundreds of times. You know, the Jim Ross call is so immortal. And I was, you know, not that I want to see any team badly beaten in an international competition, but as soon as Japan scored the two goals, I'm like, ah, now we're not going to have the Jim Ross calls, you know.
Right.
When somebody stopped a damn match. Because that's all I could envision, you know, when U.S. went up 4-0, I was like, oh, we're going to get the Jim Ross, you know, when somebody stopped the damn match. And that's a way of keeping, you know, Jim's legacy and mine alive through the ridiculous calling of other sports. But it was dramatic, you know, and when I watched it with my kids, it was this emotional roller coaster. It was powerful. And I'm not, you know, I've mentioned this to JR before, and hopefully you got the message. But for me, and I'm not just saying it because it's your show, But when I had a chance to watch you fight Nate Marquardt in Las Vegas, I think in 2011, man, I was like, that fight took me to that place where a lot of people went, you know, when they saw me in the cell, because I saw these predicaments that I knew that I would have tapped out of, you know, that almost anyone out there would have tapped out of. And this is even before you, like, you really started establishing the character. Honestly, it was the first time I'd ever heard of you. And I was came away from that. I was like, who is that guy? You know, and then when you combined, you know, the skill and the desire with the, you know, with the words and the character, it connected with people on a huge level.
Yeah, I appreciate that. You know, and I was largely inspired through what you and your companions did. You know, I grew up as a wrestling fan, and I realized how important it was, as you said earlier, to stand out. Now, I got to go back to something. We were both kind of gushing over Jimmy Snuka a minute ago, but Mick, I read something. Man, I read something online that's disturbing. Is Snuka being investigated for a murder right now?
That was years and years ago. I think that was in like 82. It was ruled accidental. He talks about it in his book. You know, he has a book out where he talks about it. I have no idea if they went back and investigated. I don't know. There was definitely a body. It was definitely, you know, a girlfriend, and I don't know that much more about it. I think it was investigated at the time. I wouldn't be surprised if they did reopen it. Jimmy's fallen on some really hard times. I hope it's not true. That's all I can say. It's the first I'm hearing of it being reinvestigated, but there was an incident, you know, many, many years ago.
Yeah,
and ruled accidental.
And I know all about that. And I did just read something, though. And maybe I should have Googled it before I asked you about it. But they did reopen it. Now, they may have closed it by now already, too. But they did reopen it. And there was some real fugazi things. You know, you talk about hard times. One of the best financial lines that I've ever heard in my life. And I took business class in college. I took finance in college. One of the best lines I've ever had is from you. And your sentence was real simple. It's not what you made. It's how much you kept. And I wish every athlete would hear that line because, man, I see it in my own industry, Mick. We spend it like it's always going to be coming in, forgetting that life is going to be long, hopefully, and those checks aren't going to be.
Yeah, and I think everyone should watch the 30 for 30 special, Broke, and find out how easily it is to fall into that trap. Yeah, and I mean, that's not a saying that I invented by any means. I mean, it was passed down to me by Bronco Lubitsch and Skandor Akbar. And I remember Bronco Lubitsch is an old-school wrestler turned referee. He was a referee so beloved in the world-class championship wrestling area, you know, based in Dallas. They kept him on as a referee even when he couldn't get down to make the count, so he'd actually count with his foot. Or just tell you to kick out if you didn't feel like counting. Kind of throw you off your game a little bit. But I came back to visit the Sportatorium in 1990 when I got my initial break with World Championship Wrestling. I don't want to confuse people. There was a WCW and a WCCW. WCW was Ted Turner's, his international organization, world class, was based out of Dallas. And he pulled me aside as if he was angry with me, and he just said, I don't ever want to hear you buying a Cadillac or any of the things that guys do when they get the money. It's really, man, it's really important, yeah, for people to remember that. And if I could go back and correct one thing, it would be just to never have thought I needed to, improve my lifestyle. So one of my, recent triumphs was that I decided not to take my oldest son's ruling that my 2002 Chevy Venture was no longer drivable, and I watched as the snow it piled up on, we had a rough winter in the Northeast. It's under like 2 feet of snow, and it occurred to me that in the same way that neither Dale Doback or Brennan Huff had any background with power tools or carpentry, quoting a little Step Brothers for you here, that my son had no background in automotive classes. So I had it checked out for myself, and for $800, I got it back and running on the road. And, like, the kids, they won't go near it.
Sure.
I'm like, I'm going to drive this thing.
Embarrassing.
Yeah, it is embarrassing. The younger kids now appreciate the memories we had, and they're glad to have it back. But as long as I have that thing, it feels, you know, weird. It's, like, symbolic of keeping my feet on the ground and remembering that, you know, this stuff doesn't last forever.
You know, I was in Chicago for a UFC. We were all out. A little group of us the night before, and we were having a nacho or whatever, some little bar, and they had stopped serving dinner. I got there so late, and CM Punk was there, and he says, "Why? I know a place," and he's from Chicago. This is his hood. So he says, "You know, I know a place up the road. They're still serving," and there was four of us plus him, so five. And we said, "Yeah, we want to go." So he says, "All right, wait here." So we go outside. It's freezing cold. It's January in Chicago. And pretty soon down the road, I mean, you could hear it from a block away, comes this car. And it's the reason you could hear it, it was a fan belt or a tailpipe or whatever it was. I don't know enough about cars, but, man, this thing was screaming. And it pulls up, and CM Punk pulls on the curb and gets out. And so there's four of us that are supposed to get in. Now, this is a two-door car. It does have, you know, one of those makeshift back seats just big enough to set some groceries. So
yeah.
Four of us pile in there, and there's still one remaining. And at that point, Punk just pops the trunk. So we're like, no, we're not getting in the trunk of this thing. We end up squeezing in. We're sitting on each other's lap. And I'm with one of the bosses of the UFC on top of that. You know, these aren't just some guys. We're also with a boss here. So we go up the road, and this was Punk's car, but there was a message in that, and there was one that I appreciated, which is basically what we're talking about. You know, you've got to hang on to that stuff, and if the car still drives and can get you from point A to point B, why not sit in it still and get to point A to point B?
Oh, man, that's been an ongoing discussion in my family. I claim a car is just a device to get you from one place to another, and, you know, and... others in the family disagree that it's an expression of, you know, your persona. So I would tell anybody who's out there who's making some money to take it. You know, it doesn't last. And even a case, you know, like I've been really fighting this sciatica in my right leg for a long time. It's really been slowing me down, affecting the way I walk. I was just in this more breaking news for you, Chael. I'm in the shower. I'm not even performing any stretches or anything. And I just feel something in my left glute. And I'm like, I think it's hurt my back. And I got out of the shower. I could barely walk. And then, I contemplated canceling a few appearances. And I'm like, I cannot. You know, I've got these things coming up. You know, three dates in Florida. Like, I can't. Like, I just can't. So I don't care what condition I'm in. When I'll sit in a chair and I'll just ask people to accept that I'm not going to be up and quite as animated as I usually am. But I mean, something like that can now set me back because I won't be. You know, I'll have to work on that, and I've got fairly major surgical process coming up in the beginning of August. But I think anyone out there should understand. Yeah, it's an opportunity, whether it's wrestling or UFC, and I think the turnover is even quicker in MMA, a lot quicker, because in WWE, you know, they can really build stars, and, you know, wins and losses are obviously a completely different thing in what we do. And, you know, I'm looking at the list of top fighters, and I'm like, God, the guys who stand out to me are the guys who either scored dramatic victories or the guys who have made me care about them, you know, guys and ladies, I should say, you know, through dramatic fights or promos. But, yeah, again, echoing your thought, it doesn't last forever.
I got to tell you, I'm glad you didn't pull out of an appearance, because the rumors that would have circled about, nobody would have believed you. With what you've been through, if we put out a report, Mick Foley out due to shower injury. No, okay. No, everyone's going to think that it's a lie. Mick Foley injured in the shower after everything you've been through. So I'm glad that you didn't attempt that one.
Last year, I did have to pull out of one date in Denver. And if people had any, you know, were skeptical at all about the injury, because it was, sciatic nerve just basically laying me out for 3 weeks. And it was like, well, he's not just canceling his date in Denver. He's canceling the professional Santa Claus school in Colorado Springs as well. And then people knew it was a legit injury.
Wow. Hey, are you following CM Punk now? Are you following that he's over with the UFC and getting ready for his debut?
Yeah, man. Yeah.
Are you surprised at all that he, you know, everybody thought, well, okay, we get this. It's a publicity move. Let's bring CM Punk over. He can work some of that entertainment that you and I are talking about. But he hasn't. It's the one thing he has not done is open his mouth and do any kind of hype. Has that surprised you?
Yeah. I mean, I think when the time and the place is right for him, you know, when he has a fight on the books and it's time to promote it, that he'll do his best to make it must-see TV. And when I've been asked about it, and I don't get asked much, I just said, look, I don't know how he's going to do. Honestly, I don't know, but I know that no one will outwork him, no one will out-train him, and he'll leave it all out there, you know, in the octagon. So I know he's taking it very seriously. And we'll all find out, you know. But like I said, if he's not successful, it sure won't be for lack of trying.
You know, he didn't have the look that Vince McMahon has always been known to be after. You know, Vince definitely has an ideology in his head of what a main eventer looks. And you didn't either. You know, you were a lot bigger guy than Punk, but it was different than that bodybuilder physique that Vince is known for. Did you have troubles breaking through that and becoming a main event star?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I had trouble just getting my name acknowledged, you know, when it came time to look for new talent. And it was Bruce Pritchard, who was Vince's right-hand man, who told me only last summer the reason behind the Mankind mask, and this is something I said in the WWE Network special, so if anyone has seen it, I apologize for repeating material. And had I known about this, Chael, it probably would have stung. Like, I don't know if I would have come into the company had I known, like, this was the caveat. But he said that at a certain point, you know, after Jim Ross had pushed for me for a couple of years, that Mr. McMahon just slammed his hand down on the table and said, all right, damn it, I'll bring him in, but I'm covering up his face.
Oh, God.
and it was like, for anyone wondering, like, geez, Mr. McMahon's a genius, there must be a deep psychological meaning for that, you know, leather mask that Mankind wore. And it's like, no, there was none. Just one man's quest to cover up another man's face. So, I definitely had to fight against that and the, you know, the unusual body type. Fortunately, I was in a situation where, you know, they needed new talent. And they needed experience. You know, they needed experienced talent. And The Undertaker, obviously, you know, held a lot of sway in the company, and he was looking to wrestle somebody who wasn't just like big. He was looking for somebody, you know, he could, you know, create a program with. And you know, I'd say, you know, between that 1991 series of matches with Sting that Dusty Rhodes helped bring about, and the matches with The Undertaker in 1996, those would be my biggest, you know, the ones that helped my career the most.
When you look at NXT, do you follow that much? Do you check
yeah,
out that?
Yeah, I love NXT.
Well, who do you think is going to be the next big star? Do they got somebody over there that when they become TV ready can go all the way to the top and headline a WrestleMania?
Yeah, I think we're seeing it, you know. And one of the smart things that you know, Hunter did was create a venue there at Full Sail University that, you know, with the exception of the, you know, the huge amount of fans, approximates what, you know, down to the finest detail, what guys can expect when they get to WWE. So it's the same stage at NXT, it's the same lighting, it's the same cameras, so guys aren't coming in with maybe years of experience, but no experience in front of the camera. And in some cases, I'd seen really good wrestlers come in for their tryouts who had worked around the world, but had never actually used ring ropes. They were always the elevator cables with a little bit of rubber over them. And guys would slip, they'd fall, and be written off almost immediately. And so in this case, they're really getting people ready. And I think, you know, it's the toughest thing about that question, Jael, is trying to figure out which guys, because Kevin Owens is getting that huge break, and it came pretty quickly. Guys like Finn Balor, you know, just,
sure,
you know, tore down the house in Japan, and Chris Jericho and Neville had this amazing match, and it's just a matter of which guy catches fire. And I think, speaking of catching fire, if WWE does the right thing with the women in NXT, they could completely change the way, you know, that, that women's wrestling is looked at, and really, I think, contribute to the way, you know, that women's you know, sports are looked at as well.
Now, that's interesting you bring that up, because, see, we're seeing that over in MMA with the UFC. We've got this star named Ronda Rousey.
Yeah.
We got another emerging star, a Polish gal named Joanna Champion, and we call her last name Champion because none of us can pronounce Jett or Jacek. So she just told us, call me Champion, which was added to the character. But the point is, we're seeing that in MMA, too. You know, we're really seeing these women take over a sport that was dominated by men until just recently. Is there going to be a time? Do you think the WWE has a woman right now that eventually can come out and be a Ronda Rousey, can really top a card?
Well, I think the four women, Sasha Banks, Ric Flair's daughter, Charlotte, Becky Lynch, and Bayley in NXT could come over as a foursome. I'm afraid if they come over one at a time, they'll get absorbed into the system instead of changing it. I think if they come in as a foursome and they do the right thing, and I can't stress like how important this is to me. Like, if I was a politician, this would be my one issue I would talk constantly about, that these women have the chance to make such a major difference. And I think if Ronda chooses to get into the ring at WrestleMania, it will create a phenomenal amount of attention. And I think, you know, in positive attention. I was there in San Jose when she showed up. You know, and it was like there was that definite buzz. Like everyone, you know, even people who didn't know MMA or UFC knew who Ronda Rousey was. And then when The Rock brought her into the ring, it all made perfect sense. So I don't know what their plans are. I mean, I don't know if there's, you know, on Ronda's end, you know, if it's something she can do or would like to do. But if she chose to do it, I mean, there's your answer there. I mean, that could be your main event right there.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I was there in San Jose, too, and that place went insane when they panned to Ronda, which did surprise me a little bit. We love her, but I didn't know that they would all know who she was. I mean, they absolutely went crazy, and I thought perhaps a little bit of a miss by the company was that not advertising her. You know, they brought her in. It was like a cameo on the fly, or at least presented that way. I thought, you know, if you would have advertised this, you I think dollar-wise, you would have sold some pay-per-views.
I don't know. There's always that surprise. The last time I was on Raw was as a surprise, and I really liked the effect it had. And I think that was the case, that buzzing, like I said, where it would all, we're all click simultaneously with people, I think may have been more valuable than the dollars it would have brought in for pay-per-view. And I with the idea that next year, if she wants it, and Stephanie, being McMahon, will train exceedingly hard, you know, to give people a match. And I think Ronda, you know, is going, would face it. I mean, she was a great swimmer, you know, world judo champion, UFC champion. I think she would approach, you know, the idea of becoming, putting on a great wrestling match with the same type of, you know, the same type of dedication.
Yeah, I guess we'll see where that goes. Now, you were wrestling at the same time as Austin and The Rock. If you had to pick what the better act was.
Man, you can't do this.
I was gonna say, can you do it? Can you pick? Because I almost feel like it's blasphemy. People ask me the question, I won't answer it.
It's impossible, man. And it would hurt somebody's feelings. You know, they were both incredible. You know, they were both. Steve was a guy, you know, at the right, right place, right time, but more importantly, the right guy. And he had a chip on his shoulder. That's Paul Heyman points out. That's so important, the fact that he came in with a chip on his shoulder and something to prove. And, I mean, you know, when Steve went down with the neck injury, you would have thought there's no way someone can step up and become as big as him. And The Rock was just this, like, phenomenon, you know, like he just, it was in his blood, third generation guy, just picked it up. And, you know, when he found his groove, when he found that character, it was just magical. But there's no way, not even you, Chael, can make me pick between the two of them.
You know, I don't blame you. I don't like to pick either. Do you watch, The Rock has a new show out called Ballers on HBO. Have you seen that?
No, but it looks great.
It's honestly great.
It looks great. Have you seen it?
I haven't missed one. They've only had three episodes, but it's excellent. It's only a half hour, and every time when it's up, I think, God, I wish this was an hour. It's very, very good TV.
It's HBO, so I've got that, so I can probably watch that demand. It looks really good, and it's about one of the subjects we touched on, right? The financial, the financial acumen.
Exactly, the good and the bad. And as I watch it, yeah, it's entertaining. It's even kind of a comedy. Some of the pundits have listed it as a comedy, but there is definitely a true message to it. It's very real to life.
I'll put it on my must-see list.
I think you should check it out.
I definitely will.
All right, now, Mick, you were there the night, God bless him, but the night that Owen Hart fell. What was that like behind the scenes?
Man, it was so... Yeah, surreal doesn't do it justice.
When did you realize that things went wrong, Mick? I mean, at first, are you guys like us at home going, oh, this is a work, it's an angle, or do you know, no, this is
a
problem?
The strange thing about that night is I wasn't really in the mix. I was in a 10-man tag team match, and it wasn't necessary that I approached it with the same type of emotional zeal that I usually would. I knew I was just playing a role in a match, and I was writing a book at the time. And so I was literally off by myself in an office with no one else. I don't even think anyone had talked to me about the match. The match is really secondary to the book, which, you know, turned out to be Have a Nice Day, that I was working on. And so I was just in an office with a monitor, and I looked over to the monitor, and I saw, like, just a crowd shot. And I thought, wow, that's strange. And then 5-10 minutes later, I looked over, and it's still the same crowd shot. And my only thought was they must be having technical difficulties. And then it was Pat Patterson who came in, and he goes, oh, did you... And I won't even try to do Pat's French-Canadian accent. It's not really appropriate for the story. But he said, did you see what happened to Owen? I said, no. And he goes, yeah, Owen fell. And then Pat just broke into tears. He goes, they don't know if he's alive or dead. I just went racing down that,
oh my God,
the hallway. And when I got there, there was a guy named Francois Petit, and he was performing CPR. I was standing on top of the gurney performing CPR on Owen. And it was just, like nothing I had ever done in life had prepared me for that moment, you know, and calling my kids. I remember, you know, telling my daughter about this, you know, that they watched all the pay-per-views, and usually it was me calling home to assure them that I was okay. And in this case, I called home, and, you know, and my daughter's going, where is him? You know, we're talking about Owen, and I said, I was crying, you know, I loved Owen, really was one of my best friends. And said, you know, he's gone, honey, he's with the Angels. And she said, but where is him? And she hadn't heard, you know, she'd never heard her dad break down like that. It was just devastating. And I couldn't tell you a single thing that happened in that match. It didn't even occur to me when I saw blood in the ring and the where the boards were broken. I remember the referee telling us, look, the boards are broken in the corner. And like it was all just a blur. I mean, it was just this. It was by far the worst. You know, the worst experience, worst night in wrestling history, as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, I completely agree. And I bring it up fragilely, but also respectfully. I like to keep, I like to keep his memory alive, and I also like to point out the fact that, you know, accident, you got to be really careful. You know, you never want history to relive itself, and it does. It unfortunately does in our society, and in business as a whole. So at any rate, thank you for answering that, and I'm kind of apologetic to have brought it up, but it's a memorable night for me too. You know, I was at home just as a fan. I was in college. We all ordered the pay-per-view. We all watched it, and as many times as the King and Jim Ross assured us as viewers it was not an angle, the more we were convinced it was.
And, you know, and hoping that it was.
Praying that it was. Absolutely. You absolutely wanted to believe it. And the show went on. But, you know, as the next characters and the next wrestlers came out, smart marks were reading through their body language going, man, something's going on here.
Yeah.
And this is just
tough.
As the internet was coming out.
You don't apologize for bringing it up. I mean, it was a huge part of our history, and I think Owen is sometimes overlooked. And I'm going to tell you, like, this is like the nicest thing, among the nicest things that anyone has ever said to me. I was really proud of the fact that when I went to, or touched by the fact that when I did my show in Calgary, like 17 different hearts came out, even hearts who don't usually talk to each other. You know, they came out to support me in Calgary. And they always appreciated, you know, that Owen liked me. And I had at one time quit the WWE for one full day after the Montreal.
Whole day, long walk out there. Good discipline.
It was one day, and then my wife basically read my contract to me, where I just realized I breached my contract and couldn't work anywhere in the world for the next 5 years. And I came back that next day, but the one day was lockout was one day longer than anyone but Owen, and I think, you know, and Jim, any non-family member had walked out, and I think the hearts always appreciated that. And I love traveling around with Lindsay, one of the heart nieces, and when I go out to Western Canada, she'll help me out with my shows and sell merchandise, and she dropped me off at the hotel, and she said, hey, I have this little card for you. And I said, oh, thank you. And I went upstairs, and I read it. It was just the nicest thing. It said, you remind me so much of my Uncle Owen, and part of the reason I love spending time with you is that I feel like I'm getting some of the time back that was, you know, taken away from me.
Wow.
That's among the nice things anybody's ever said about me. So, yeah, no problem. I'm bringing up Owen that was an awful night, but what a great guy, and really happy that WWE's coming out with the DVD set that I think anyone from that era will really appreciate.
Yeah, well, that's awesome. Listen, Mick, we are out of time, buddy. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it. This was really fun. I am legitimately a huge fan. If people want to follow you, they can go to @RealMickFoley on Twitter. That's actually how I found you. Is there anything else you'd like to mention or drop or plug?
Just anything. I try to keep it real, Chael, so it's Twitter's RealMickFoley, Facebook is RealMickFoley, and even the website is realmickfoley.com. I appreciate your listeners tuning in, looking past my lack of knowledge about the current MMA product, and I think we all had a good time.
No, it's awesome, man. I know we did. I appreciate you, Mick. Thanks so much. I will send you the link to this in case you want to listen while you're down in the Santa cave.
I appreciate that. Have a great day, Chael.
You're awesome. Thanks, pal. Take care.
Bye.
All right, guys. Mick Foley. Wow. The funnest part about doing these podcasts is having guys like that come on who you want to be a great guy, but you never know. And that was a really great guy. How personable was he? What an easy guy to talk to. And, you know, one of the things that I do when I line up these podcasts is I very seldomly talk to the guests, you know, unless it's like a friend or somebody that I know or somebody I've got a past with. When I have a stranger on, and Mick was until today, I've never spoke to Mick, never heard his voice. He's never heard mine until right then. And one of the reasons I line it up that way, I did this through Twitter, or sometimes I'll do a text or an email. It's all basically the same thing in terms of you're just writing a guy. But the reason is, a lot of times when you finally meet someone like that, you guys hit it off and it's a really fun conversation. I want to make sure that I record it to make a part of the show so that you guys can all listen. But Wow, you know, we've only got an hour for this podcast. I'm looking at my clock, and it just flew by. I should have done a two-part special. There was so much more to get into that guy. What a real guy. I mean, I could ask him anything. And he just went with it and was a very relaxed and great guest. All right. Well, as I just stated, I am out of time. They're throwing me out of here. They've had enough of me, and I've had it with all of you anyway. So until next Wednesday, go to badguyinc.com. Check out the merchandise. Thank you all for listening. Enjoy your week. I'm Chael Sonnen, and you are welcome.
Thanks for listening to You're Welcome with Chael Sonnen. Download new episodes every week at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.